You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
One of the cool parts of my job here at All Marine Radio is getting to meet people whose works I've read, and then getting to the chance to talk to them about those works and the research they've done, and today's a good example of that. And joining me is a man who needs no introduction to Marines, and that is Eric Hamill. Eric, first of all, thanks for doing this, and welcome back to All Marine Radio.
Thank you for inviting me.
No, our pleasure. We are going to talk about Chosen. It's that time of the year. And I spent a couple hours last night reading and doing research and watching some stuff. And I guess I'll ask you a couple general questions to start. Has the United States ever fought under those kind of circumstances, sub-zero weather, surrounded?
Sure, right across Europe in the winter of 1944-45.
Where?
Terrible winter. It was the worst winter on record, as I recall.
I don't know the weather was that extreme, though, was it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't live it. I couldn't tell you. I was raised in a cold place. Actually, I was raised not far from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, which everybody claims was, you know, a terrible, terrible winter for the Continental troops.
Right.
But they were in bivouac the whole time.
Right. So Bastogne...
Fighting outside in the winter, something else.
So Bastogne would be the closest.
I'm sorry?
So would Bastogne would be the closest?
It was bad one, you know. I mean, I think the whole battlefield in Europe at that time was pretty bad.
Okay. All right. That would be
the Germans were desperate. They were putting up more resistance than say the Chinese put up at Chosin Reservoir. I'm not trying to make a nefarious comparison, but you ask.
Well, no, I was trying to get my hands around, and I don't, and so we could compare them. The temperature's certainly more extreme.
Oh, minus 35, yeah, you know.
Right, and then I don't know that they couldn't get air support in Bastogne, but were they actually surrounded and cut off?
At some point, yes.
Okay. All right. Okay, all right. So it would be on the short list. You have to choose from Bastogne and the Chosin Reservoir. I want to ask you about O.P. Smith. I watched a little bit about him last night. He's a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, and he finds himself of the command of the 1st Marine Division as they go ashore and they move towards the Yalu River. In what is, and again, depending on who you read and what you believe, this movement to the Yalu. After breaking the Pusan perimeter, the landing at Incheon, yada, yada, yada. He works for General MacArthur, the Supreme Allied Commander there in the Far East, and he works for General Allman. Can you describe the command relationship, the two guys he works for?
Well, my understanding of Smith is that he was a man of great moral rectitude and very few words. I often thought when I was writing the book, I didn't meet Smith, but I met his G3, which is Alpha Bowser, who retired as lieutenant general in the end. I think Bowser had more to do with the planning and the thought processes that went on than General Smith did. In a lot of ways, I found General Smith to be a gray eminence in the thing. He was there. He was influencing things. but he didn't have a lot to say. Bowser was the guy.
What about the...
Bowser at the age of 40 planned the Inchana invasion.
That's pretty high quality work.
Yeah, very high quality work. He'd been 3rd Marine Division G3 in at least one operation in the Pacific. I don't remember whether it was Guam or Bougainville. But he'd done the job, just like a lot of other people at the Chosin Reservoir. They had done the job in the previous war that they had in Korea.
The, Bowser served as an observer during the New Georgia campaign as the assistant G3 and G3 of the 3rd Marine Division during Bougainville in November and December of 1943 for... heroic achievement in the latter assignment, he was awarded his first Bronze Star. In February of 1944, he was given command of the 3rd 105mm Howitzer Battalion, 12th Marines, 3rd Marine Division, awarded his second Bronze Star for outstanding service in the recapture of Guam, and then he returned to the United States. And then he, in the same capacity, wins his first Legion of Merit with a Combat V during the Iwo Jima campaign.
I didn't realize he was still out in the Pacific during Iwo Jima.
That's not a bad little resume Alpha Bowser puts together. Talk about the command above him. What is MacArthur like in this period? What is Allman like? And is there a MEF? Are we talking about, at that time, what did we use? Commander Amphibious Task Force? And that person, we knew him when he was ashore. Who was the MEF commander at this time, or the equivalent?
There wasn't a MEF commander. There was a Corps commander. That was Allman.
All right.
This is a land campaign.
Allman's the Corps commander. And so what's Allman like?
Allman had a strange reputation, and certainly amongst Marines, it was pretty well loathed. He was a Southerner. He had commanded, I can't remember, you're really putting me on the spot if you were to ask me this, but he commanded one of the all-black divisions, the one that went to Europe and fought in Italy. There was actually a Spike Lee movie about that, and that somebody played Allman in the movie. I mean, he was a character in the movie. I can't remember the name of the movie off the top of my head. He was a yes man, very much a follower, but he had, you know, the merits. I mean, he'd earned his way. He punched his ticket, and he'd earned his way into that Corps command, 10th Corps. And he dealt directly with Smith, who I gather didn't have any time for him.
Okay.
He was a showboat in a lot of ways. There was an incident where he made a flying leap, early in the, Chosin campaign to a battalion, an army battalion that was on the other side of the reservoir, but trying to fight its way out. And he just awarded everybody he ran into a Silver Star. I mean, cooks, bakers, didn't matter. Everybody got a Silver Star with, you know, no thought whatsoever. He was buying votes, I guess. Nobody listened much to Ned Allman.
All right. And then what about MacArthur in all of this?
Well, MacArthur was the generalissimo. I mean, he was the haughty head of Far East, the Emperor of the Far East, actually, taken over from the Emperor of Japan. He surrounded himself with yes men also, and so Allman fit right in. He telegraphed what he desired the intelligence to be and got the reports to back him up, that there was nobody out there to stop that advance to the Alu. It was, going to be cream puffs all the way.
Hmm.
He was wrong.
It's very interesting, because general officers can have that effect.
yeah, well, that's what they're there for, right?
Well, you know, it's very interesting to sit in staff meetings, and when they pontificate, you know, what they think. It takes the confident staff officer to look them in the face and say, I don't see it like that, General. And well, it makes for interesting viewing, that's for sure.
He made the classic error of trying to determine the desires of his followers, his subordinates, the desires of his enemies, rather than their capabilities. He considered them to be not quite up to the task, put it mildly.
Okay.
And they were. They were.
All right. Before we get done with kind of the order of battle, the three regimental commanders are Puller, Murray, and Lutzenberg.
Right.
Of RCT 1, 5, and 7. Any thoughts on any of them before I start?
Yeah, well, Lutzenberg was I think, the senior colonel in the Marine Corps at that time, certainly the senior regimental commander. He'd been selected for brigadier general and didn't want to relinquish his post while there was still enemy in the field. Ray Murray's an interesting character. He was lieutenant colonel all the way through Incheon and through the Pusan perimeter, and subsequent to that, he was still lieutenant colonel of the Chosin Reservoir.
And he's 1-7, yes.
Ray Murray was CO 5th Marines.
But I thought you said Ray Davis.
Right. I think I said Ray Murray.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I had the pleasure of meeting him and interviewing him for this book.
Wow, I'm jealous.
He was an interesting character in that he is the template for High Pockets in Leon Uris' Battle Cry.
Wow.
He was the real guy.
Okay.
I don't know where the crossover line was on was he more High Pockets or less High Pockets, but he was High Pockets in Leon Uris'
So Lutzenberg is RCT-7. Lieutenant Colonel Ray Davis, Raymond Davis, is who's a Medal of Honor runner. Is 1st Battalion 7th.
Ray Davis was 1-7, yes.
Right, he's 1-7. All right. Raymond Murray, another legend in the Marine Corps, who will acquit himself well. He's RCT-5. Any thoughts on him?
On Murray?
Yes. On Ray Murray.
On Ray Murray. Well, as I said, he was the template for High Pockets. He was a very steady guy. I remember being impressed with him. He had no notes for an interview that he's a very smart man. Everybody acknowledges that he was a very smart man. He commanded 2-6 actually at the Guadalcanal in the later stages. Not much action there. He commanded 2-6 again at Tarawa. As a lieutenant colonel, he'd been a major on Guadalcanal. He was 29 years old when he got a battalion. He didn't do much on Tarawa. They landed on the next island over and basically plugged the Japanese in. And at Saipan, he was wounded, I believe, on the first day by plunging fire, artillery fire. He didn't actually see that much action, and when he had the 5th Marines, I believe on Guam initially, when the war started, he had a truncated battalions. I believe he didn't have a 1st Battalion. The 2nd Battalion and the 3rd Battalion were made up of two infantry companies each. So there wasn't really even, I mean, they talk about the brigade, there wasn't even a regiment.
In the brigade, that's not supposed to be, that's not exactly.
But he won through. I mean, he was enormously successful at Pusan.
That is not normally the way we draw that up. That is not normally we draw those brigades up. The way we draw those brigades up. Your thoughts on Chesty Puller? Who's a legendary Marine, but certainly not without his detractors in history, and certainly not without controversy.
Well, I think a lot of the detractors were people who were close to him, and they weren't so much detractors as realistic. They found out that he he wasn't all-seeing and didn't walk on water quite. They handled them realistically, particularly at Guadalcanal, where the war itself was a new kind of war, that the Marines had not really trained to be left on a beach high and dry. wasn't in the plan. And there was relief in the Pacific when he first entered combat that, you know, Chessie will take care of it. And after a fashion, he did. I found, through talking to a lot of people, particularly his subordinates, and particularly his subordinates in 1-7 when he had it at Guadalcanal, that he really couldn't visualize a battlefield without seeing it. And he got at least one of his Navy crosses by sitting up with his head exposed, looking at the battlefield. It brought tears to the eyes of his young Marines, you know, the COs, you know, going to see what's out there and protect us from whatever he sees. But his young office, college-educated officers, who were, you know, basically guys who were serving their country in wartime, said, this is no way to run an infantry battalion. But, you know, it worked. By the time he got to Peleliu, he was very hard. I mean, he was a hard guy anyway, but he was very hard and might have been suffering from some mental fatigue. He'd had a leave in the States between New Britain and Peleliu, and I don't know. He just got, there's a quality in you read about him and read backstory from other people about him. And there was just a harshness that hadn't been there before, a different kind of cold-bloodedness.
All right, I want to switch gears, and I want to talk about as the division comes ashore, because one of the things I saw last night was all the different encounters they had with the Chinese, with Chinese soldiers, before, in fact, they got near the Yalu. And so it's still kind of a general discussion. When the division comes ashore, when did they first bump into Chinese soldiers that they identify as Chinese soldiers and not North Koreans?
Middle of November.
That early. And what's the general vicinity? I mean, if they do it in the middle
of November. On the MSR up towards the Chosin Reservoir, not at the Chosin Reservoir. I frankly can't remember the name of the little town that they were hit in. They had some warning. This here again is MacArthur's intelligence team on point. Marine scouts were finding evidence of Chinese soldiers rather than retreating North Korean People's Army soldiers. And they were reporting it, and higher officers were getting the word and trying to factor out, you know, noise and figure out what was going on, and the Chinese just did it. They just attacked. And there was a battle, and then they went away, and that was the last anybody thought about them. I mean, not anybody, but that was the last that the higher officials thought about them.
So
until the attack that, you know, in the case of the 1st Division, at and then the approaches to the reservoir.
So
local commanders were, like, for example, Ray Davis, who you mentioned, had 1-7, and he was aggressive. Others were more passive or more cautious. But there was no directive from above on any of that I've been able to find or think of.
Was there a sentiment in terms of the division intelligence guys? Did they believe? Because one of the things I saw last night was that O.P. Smith and then taking you at your expertise, Alpha Bowser, as they move up. They stage logistics, they build airfields, they do things to sustain themselves that seemed to be much more deliberate than the pace that that General Allman wanted him to move at.
Well, I mean, they were looking at bad weather, the beginnings of bad weather, and then, you know, bad weather itself in the flesh. It wasn't an easy move. They had a narrow channel for moving all of their heavy equipment, including 155 field guns. And they were spread out. They were spread out over basically a two-division front because of the 7th Infantry Division. Was it the 7th? Now I can't think of that. Yeah, I think the 7th Infantry Division. I'm sorry. Yes, definitely the 7th Infantry Division, which my father served in World War II. So MacArthur's sitting in GHQ in Tokyo, looking at maps and not real people doing stuff, and says, "Well, it's only 10 miles from here to there. You know, how long does it take as a whole division to go 10 miles? It's motorized." So that got translated down to his G3, and it got translated down to his G2. And they suddenly found the roads were open and, you know, bright skies ahead, spring on the other side of the next hill, and everything was going to be just Jim Dandy, and we'll all get you home by Christmas. Yeah. Not quite.
So is that how the division saw it as well? Did they participate?
No, I think it was because they weren't getting orders directly from MacArthur down through Almond. And, well, 8th Army was in there, too,
right.
Down through Almond to O.P. Smith. There wasn't really anything to talk about officially at a high level. I mean, other than be cautious, don't move any faster than you need to. Maintain contact front and rear and off the flanks if you can do it. They were in high mountains on a narrow track, as I said, with the river running through it. And our giant reservoir, keeping them at a distance from one another and from friends. Parts of the 7th Division started moving in just before. Well, give you an example. 5th Marines pulled out on the afternoon of the night of the attack, the first Chinese major attack. And they were just in this town called Yudam Ni, which just happened to be the front, because that's as far as anybody got. 7th Marines were in Yudam Ni. 5th Marines come in and just start bivouacking wherever they can find enough space to do that, not tactically, administratively. With an eye towards self-protection, but they weren't at the top of some of the hills, or they might have had some isolated companies. In fact, they did have isolated companies. The 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, wasn't even an intact unit. Fox Company was up at Tok Pong Pass, outposting a narrow defile. Company E and Company F. Do I have that right? No, Company G. Were independent. The battalion commander was back at Hagaruri, which was about 12 miles down the road, back down the road. They had to make a tactical defense, out of, just where they happened to be.
And so, MacArthur is saying, "Hey, you're motorized 10 miles. We're going to be at the Yalu. Everybody home for Christmas." Because it's one thing for your PAOs to put that out. It's quite another, given the fact that we've already bumped into Chinese soldiers once, and maybe this is Mac, the reactionary, or maybe it's just the hard lessons I learned in Iraq. But my job is that I get paid to foresee the unpopular, to guard against being blindsided. And so for me, one of the lessons the Iraqis taught me was nothing is as it appears. Whatever you're seeing, they want you to see that. And your job is to have your head in the game and have it on and be looking 360 degrees because they are pretty good at deception and then blindsiding you. It's how they make a living and how they stay alive. The attitude of the first division going north was a little bit more cautious than obviously MacArthur was and Allman was, but still in administrative.
Not cautious, deliberate.
Okay, deliberate. Now, can I one of the things I saw last night said that and Task Force Faith is a part of this. They're on the eastern side of the reservoir. One of the things I saw that said information that has been made available, I don't know, in the last 15, 20 years, has changed the way that we look at Task Force Faith. And that information came directly from the Chinese. And they said, evidently, at least according to what I saw last night, that Task Force Faith was the thing that screwed their plan up because they intended to come down heavily on the eastern side of the reservoir.
Where they thought the 5th Marines were.
Okay. All right. So it's
so they got Task Force Faith, which was basically a reinforced battalion, but they missed out on the pleasure of attacking the 5th Marines, the most experienced unit the Marines had in action.
Okay, so what you're looking at is as the Marines came ashore, they initially hit the Chinese, and they were the Chinese deliberately drawing them into this ambush?
No, they were moving down from the north, from Manchuria, across the Yalu, and seeking out movement to contact without actually contacting. They were shadowing, I guess is a better word. So if they were the narrow defile leading up to the Chosin Reservoir and beyond, then the Chinese were over the hill on the other side.
Okay. All right. So that's how the two forces get in proximity to each other.
Well, they're almost entangled without realizing. I mean, I don't say they didn't realize it. The Marines didn't realize it.
Right. The Chinese certainly did, though, yes?
The Chinese must have.
Okay. All right. The Chinese goal, I was reading, was to literally destroy the 1st Marine Division, knowing the history of the division in World War II. Talk about the Chinese their goals for this, again, the onset of the Chinese involvement in the Korean War. What were their goals in the vicinity of the Chosin Reservoir?
All right. Well, their motivation was that the 8th Army and 10th Corps, which was on the 8th Army was on the western side of the peninsula, and 10th Corps, which was the 1st Marine Division, 7th Infantry Division, 3rd Infantry Division, moving up, right, were on the east side of the peninsula. The Chinese were interested mainly in protecting their hydroelectric base in Manchuria from the Yalu on north. They expected to lose their industrial capacity if the Marines got to the Yalu. And that wasn't something that boded well. So they moved the forces they had, which happened to have been mostly former nationalist forces, dragooned into the Red Army, the Yankee, the PLA, People's Liberation Army. And they had plenty of cannon fodder. If they all died, nobody would have been lamenting it in Peking. In any case, they moved on foot. I mean, F-4U pilots searching out beyond the battlefield, poking their heads in wherever they could from the air, you know, saw caravans moving literally with camels in the winter in north of the Yalu River, saw Chinese troops, moving down towards congregating, on the one road that the 10th Corps was using to get north. Their goal was to annihilate, but at the very least, if possible, but at the very least to turn back the 10th Corps, and over on the other side of the peninsula, the 8th Army was to be blocked for the same reason, by a much larger force. But their idea was to overwhelm them. They had manpower, but not technology. Actually, a lot of the stuff they brought into them was stuff that had been supplied to Chiang Kai-shek's army during World War II. I mean, there were Thompson submachine guns that appeared. You know, a lot of Soviet arms, but some units were equipped as they had been for World War II with American-made arms. They were not the best equipped army in the region at that point.
Let's talk about the fight that the 5th Marines and 7th Marines have let's lay down when you look at a map, when the initial assault happens, let's talk about where everybody is. Let's talk about the three infantry regiments, and then essentially we would now call it the MEF logistics group, but all the combat service support that supports the division. So give us kind of a lay down of who's where relative to the chosen.
Okay, the first Marines were the rear, starting from the back and forward. The 1st Battalion was holding a town called Chinangni, which was outside the battle map. It was the portal, the gateway to the Chosin Reservoir region. The 2nd Battalion was holding Kodori, where Fuller had his headquarters, I believe. There was some artillery there. But it was isolated, and it was just a place that people passed through, stop, you know, maybe to take their boots off in a warming tent, and then proceed forward. And the 3rd Battalion was at Hagaruri, getting ready to displace forward to Udamni, which was the front, the point. So the 3 battalions were split up. Fuller was in there with the center battalion, but basically he held the rear. They would have moved him forward. He was slated to move forward, but the fact of the matter is, in real terms, he was in the rear. The 5th Marines were on the east side of the perimeter the day before the attack, and the Chinese had him pinned down in their mines, and sought to annihilate them because they were separated from the division by a frozen reservoir, a small sea, large lake. And that goes to the hydroelectric. The Chosin Reservoir, actually known as the Chungjin Reservoir. Chosin is Japanese, Chungjin is Korean. Was a reservoir used to supplement the hydroelectric power in northern North Korea. So the regiment was operating as a unit under Lieutenant Colonel Murray, but it didn't arrive at Hagaru. It's just travel schedule and the way things were. The last units left first, you know, made their way down. So while the battalions were more or less coherent and cohesive within themselves, the regiment was just splashed all over the Udamni map. 7th Marines were all to the front. They were in Hagaru for a couple of days, getting ready to jump off into the wide beyond, the frozen beyond. They were tactically more sound, but they weren't necessarily in position to repel an attack. They were also intermixed with the 5th Marines. So you get a couple of companies here, a battalion there, and then the other battalion of the other regiment over here, and, you know, so forth. Lichtenberg was a let's get forward guy kind of guy. So was Ray Davis. The 2nd Battalion Commander of 7th Marines was a man who had done staff work, and I don't believe he even got overseas during World War II, but he was Lieutenant Colonel, and he deserved the battalion at that point, but didn't do too well, and was out of touch with his own troops. He didn't have a tactical unit with him at Hagaru. He was ready to move up to Udamni, and his regiment, his battalion basically had moved up. The 3rd Battalion Commander, 3rd Battalion 7th Commander was an interesting guy. His name was William Harris. He'd been captured at Corregidor, made an escape with other Marines, got recaptured, and got out, you know, at the end of the war, was released as a prisoner. His father was Major General Field Harris, who commanded the 1st Marine Aircraft Wing at that time in Korea. So he was well connected to the upper echelon. He was a nervous guy. He didn't want to be captured again. He didn't do well, mentally, which is a shame, but, that's the way it goes. And they kept him in command because his father's friends, and peers and contemporaries didn't want to ruin his chances to go, you know, up and be a general like his father. So he relieved a guy who, everybody liked better. Let's put it that way. He's kind of a stickler. He hadn't been in combat per se. So he had a heavy load to carry. Let's put it that way. The battalion commanders of the 5th Marines, the 1st Battalion was the Lieutenant Colonel by the name of John Stevens, whom, as I recall, and it has been a lot of years since I wrote this book, came in late in the game and was not that well known. The 2nd Battalion commander was, you there?
I am here. I'm listening.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I had a sound on my phone. The 2nd Battalion commander was, I believe, Hal Roisey, and the 3rd Battalion commander was Bob Tablett. I may have those two mixed around. I distinctly remember Ray Murray saying he had the two best battalion commanders in the Marine Corps in Roisey and Tablett, and he played them like a piano was his description of how he dealt with them. He felt that they were good at what they did and didn't mix up with them very much. They were competent people. So that's kind of the layout for the battalion commanders at Udamni, where the attack was going to come through at its heaviest.
Okay, so you have the division proper at Hagaruri extended down the MSR is RCT-1, and then you have RCT-5 and RCT-7 arrayed on the western side of the reservoir, around the reservoir, and headed up to the northern side of the reservoir, and that's where Udamni is. And then on the eastern side, you have Task Force Faith, where they are, and then...
Yeah, and you have elements of the 31st Infantry Regiment. Task Force Faith was the 1st Battalion 32nd Infantry Regiment.
All right, and so they're about, when you look at the map of their progress, they get about at the almost to the same parallel east-west, run that runs east-west, which is their furthest progress north when they encounter the Chinese.
The Chinese encountered them. They made the attack. There had been some gunfire and a little bit of patrol action out to the flanks, on the day of the night of the attack.
So let me ask you about that. So the day of the night of, there's no incremental increase in bumping into and patrolling as Marines are moving north.
It's no, because they were getting ready to pull up stakes anyway.
Okay. All right. So they just wanted to have
some tactical awareness of what was around them and where the danger spots were, you know, where the avenues of approach might be. Whatever a platoon or a squad out on some kind of patrol in an uncontested but dangerous, you know, battle space, we're due. It was all SOP.
Okay. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is there was no incremental increase in contact with the Chinese.
No, it was a quiet day. There might have been a little, they were noticing things like an officer out with engineering equipment taking, sightings on marine positions. Just some oddball stuff was going on at visible to the lowest levels of the division. But, the rifle platoons, the infantry squads.
And then they make contact. How long does it take?
They didn't make contact. They got attacked.
Okay. Then
they were not moving, and it was nighttime. And they just did not have the wherewithal to move at night.
So there's no doubt in anybody's mind when this thing gets unleashed, there's no doubt in anybody's mind what's happening, or is there?
Well, it happened over a very wide front. I mean, you can imagine the division headquarters, getting swamped with calls on tactical nets, the regimental commanders at the front being, pulled into all kinds of conversations about what do we do now? Everybody was looking, had the usual tunnel vision of, this I can only tell you about me, not right. going to tell you until you do something about it.
Talk to me, Eric, as you wrote the book, in this first phase of the battle, what strikes you as the key events of this first phase?
Well, not so much the key event as the key trend, that these were the troops, the lower enlisted ranks had not fought in World War II, but they had fought up through Korea. You start getting into sergeants and above, they had World War II experience. A lot of them were Iwo Jima vets. A lot of them were former raiders. A lot of them were former parachutists. They had what's described in some of the literature as battle awareness. They understood how to use their resources, their personal resources, their vision, their sense of smell, come to think of it. Chinese cooked over wood fires, and they just like in Vietnam, they smelled of smoke and cooking. I don't know, on a clear, crisp night at minus 35 with the air pretty still whether they actually smelled a lot of those guys, but people claim to have smelled. But the troop leaders, lower level troop leaders, had that awareness and were basically the coherent, cohesive force that kept the troops in line and on the firing line. The troops trusted them. For officers, you had, again, very experienced people, maybe one rank above where they'd served at the end of World War II, but probably not, and in the same position. Ray Davis was battalion commander in the 1st Marines at Peleliu. He was a battalion commander of 1-7 at the reservoir. Ray Murray was still a lieutenant colonel. He commanded a battalion. You see what I'm saying? There was enough experience there that the division's radar was up. And they knew what to do. They fell in and defended their positions, even though they were surprised. They couldn't dig in. It was rock hard, frozen earth. Most of them had to go to sleep. They had crappy shoe packs to wear on their feet, which sweated a lot. And they had to take the shoes off and leave them outside their warming tents, just to get their feet dry, their socks dry. And a lot of them were caught, without boots. They were running around on frozen earth without boots, just simply because they didn't have time to get them on. It was much more important to get the rifle working than it was to get the shoes on. But they did what Marines do. They turned to.
you've interviewed and you studied and researched this. The fight that takes place from Udemy back to Hagaruri is an incredible fight, and you know, it's its own book and in and of itself. Is there something about the whole Marine thing? I watching videos of those guys talking about when they marched back into Hagaruri, falling into step and then singing the Marines hymn as they walked in, and seeing how emotional they got about recalling that incident was absolutely amazing.
Well, it wasn't two regiments, you know, singing it all together.
No, I know. I don't need to romanticize it any further than it is, but to hear them reminisce about that.
That's something Marines do. I mean, they raise flags and they sing the Marines hymn. Everybody knows that.
It is true. That is true. We love that stuff. But why don't they get annihilated out there? There's certainly enough Chinese soldiers out there to do that.
They didn't get annihilated because they had better weapons, better training, better order of battle, experienced troops who believed in what they were doing. I told you, a lot of those Chinese troops were former nationalists who were basically put in penal battalions or penal regiments and told to attack with people armed and dangerous behind them to take them out if they turned around. I mean, how impressed do you have to be with your army and your nation to put up with that?
Give me, when you look for a key event in that first phase of the battle, point to one of them. Point to a key event that you say that you stands out in your mind in that first phase.
You know, they all stand out equally. I mean, that was the whole point. That no matter where on the line, you know, a historian could concentrate on, and then every part of the line, every part of the defenses, ad hoc as they were, met the enemy with the same attitude and the same determination. They didn't want to die, I mean, amongst other things.
No.
But they knew how not to die, and they knew the randomness of war, and they took the battle the way it was shaped.
All right, let me ask you a few more questions. You've been very, very gracious with your time. My guest today is Eric Hamill. We're talking about he's written a book called Chosen. Most Marines are familiar with it. This time of year certainly always brings that up on our calendar, and so we're talking about that today. Eric, the consolidation around Hagaruri, and then the evacuation that took place of the wounded, and then the division turns to move back through Hellfire Valley and down the MSR that RCT-1 has secured. Tell me about that.
Well, first of all, it's important to say that after the first night, by the first full morning of the battle, the Marines at Udemy did the consolidation thing. They actually expanded their perimeter because there were better positions out there a little farther out, and they pushed the Chinese back, if nothing else, it's a lesson to them. And they made a very well-thought-out retrograde movement. They reconfigured themselves to make that retrograde movement. All the planning went into, let's hold this town. These troops are going to move through these troops back to these troops, and then set up a line, and you know, on and on and on like that. So they practiced their profession at the highest level, just getting to Hagaru, and then from Hagaru was under attack itself, and the troops there had to defend at a much different disadvantage, much bigger disadvantage, because there weren't as many of them. There was a battalion plus, and odds and sods, and an army infantry company moving, to join up with the 7th Division units on the east side of the reservoir. There was an ad hoc infantry battalion composed of army, including artillery guys, whatever they could scrape up and so forth. So this was all well planned. This is, again, Al Bowser. I mean, this is the consummate planner. He planned as a young man. I mean, he was 40 in 1950. He was 35 in 1945. And, younger yet when he was at Bougainville. He was 33, 32. So this is the guy who's in charge of the planning. He's in charge of the retrograde movement. O.P. Smith didn't come out of nowhere. He'd been the 1st Marine Division assistant commander at first. He'd been in the 2nd Division and commanded a battalion of the 2nd Marines as far back as 1940. So these guys, I can't stress enough how well prepared these guys were after 5 years of war and 5 years to absorb the lessons of the war. World War II, that is.
Right.
So this is just very businesslike. I mean, it was almost paint by numbers.
No panic.
I said
no panic, sense of urgency. They had been through, as you said, these guys have been through some pretty rough stuff.
Right, and hard decisions were made. Right. Hard decisions were made. People were put in positions that they couldn't win, and somehow they won. I mean, Fox Company at Toktong Pass is a normal infantry company. That's done as much fighting as any other unit around it, is holding a hill, and it's attacked by massive forces, and holds out for days until 1/7 under the consummate professional Ray Davis, does an end run over open territory to reinforce and save Fox Company and the position that overwatched the entire division as it passed south towards Agarurri. It was all thought out. I mean, but it was people at the edge. I mean, Davis was so frostbitten, not frostbitten, but
hypothermia.
Hypothermia. He couldn't think straight. He was hallucinating and running a battalion at the same time. He was a small man. He didn't have a lot of mass to give up, in giving into the cold. These guys just knew what the hell they were doing. I mean, that's it. And they inspired one another, and they inspired the troops. That's what it took. So everything was done by the numbers. With diminishing forces, they left dead Marines at the airfield at Hagarurri because they just didn't have the means to get any more than those who were wounded and could be saved out. Those guys are still there under an airfield that was expanded into an airport, a regional airport. Those are hard decisions, very hard decisions. Which company was going to go in? I mean, which 30-man company was going to go in and attack, as if it was a full company? People making decisions about stuff like that.
And
hard decisions.
One of the things that, in addition to hard decisions, but you have, as you mentioned earlier, you have hard guys who can execute those hard decisions that have already been tested and have the will. Guys who
were already reconciled to their personal death.
That's amazing when you hear that. I was listening to it last night. Yeah, I knew I wasn't going to live, but I thought I needed to fight so that other guys could. And you hear that, and they're not saying it for effect.
No, not at all. That's the spirit, in a can. That's the essence.
The movement back down, one of the interesting things I saw in a documentary I watched last night, the movement back down towards towards the coast. They begin to cap that you see video of Chinese, you see film of Chinese, and some of them are barefoot, and you're looking at them, and they, the images of their feet, the images of their ears, and I saw some of the casualty figures for the Chinese, and they're astounding. They're absolutely, they're mind-blowing in terms of the numbers of Chinese that are estimated to be lost to the
elements. The guys who froze to death.
Froze to death, you know. In their own sweat, aided by, you know, just I can't even say it. They didn't eat enough. Malnutrition. And so it's just, but you look at it to see the video of these guys in bare feet, and they're silken.
Yeah, but their bare feet weren't like your bare feet. They've been barefoot their whole lives. Those were boots that they were wearing. They just happened to be permanently attached.
Yeah, look, not when it's minus 35.
No, but that's the way people lived in Europe in the 12th and 13th and 14th and 15th century.
It's astounding to watch it. You see these guys, you see Marines humping by in boots, you see Marines standing there guard over them, and then you see these Chinese soldiers, and you look at what they're wearing, you look at their barefoot, and you just think, good God.
You can manage troops one of two ways. You can scare the hell out of them, or you can look after them. So which was which?
I guess it depends who you are and what you're doing. Either way works, right?
Either way works. It's just, you got to be consistent.
Talk to me about two more questions, and I will let you go today. In the movement back, RCT1's back there, General Polar's back there. In the movement back down towards the coast, more the same.
No, it got easier because the Chinese high tide had the surge had been made, and now it was calm, fairly calm seas ahead. I mean, there were actions, but it got easier, except that there were fewer troops to benefit from the easier part. I mean, the last of everything was thrown in at some point or another.
Did the Chinese not have the ability to pursue because?
No, they didn't have the legs to do that.
Of the terrain.
They were getting out ahead of their supplies. Right. You mentioned malnutrition. I mean, it turns to starvation. Bullets weigh a lot. You can't run camels down in an active battle zone. They don't understand what's happening to them. the high tide dissipated as the place where the hydroelectric, I can't remember the name. You have a map. You look it up.
Where they blew the bridge?
The penstocks, right. Where they had to throw a bridge.
Talk about that. I mean, I was watching, I had read about it. I'd never actually seen. You know, and last night I watched the video of it, and it was absolutely amazing. And I told you before that I had looked at images of and tried to figure out, like, well, I'll be able to. I mean, there can't be that many roads in the vicinity of the reservoir.
None. There was one. That was the MSR.
Right. And I'll be able to see, you know, I'll be able to see easily, you know, where they went. And so I tried to, and I was like, there's no way. And that's how I wound up downloading. All the different push pins and the Google Earth overlay, that I ultimately download. And I'm looking at this power plant, and I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me. They ran the division through this? And I just, it's one thing to read about it, but, you know, with the magic of Google Earth now, and you can actually go and look at the terrain, you look at it and you think, you've got to be kidding me. there's no way they did this, and sure as hell they did it. So, what? In retrospect, you published the book how many years ago?
1982, it came out, maybe 81.
When you look back on it, for you as a writer, what is significant about the book?
That it happened the way it happened. I mean, that they got out. The good guys won. They had no business winning. They didn't have good air support. I mean, they had good people trying to support them, but they didn't have good air support because of weather. What they had was that bridge. That bridge not being there. It was airdropped. It was an army bridge. It was airdropped and moved up. It was a standard issue treadway bridge, which means it was designed for vehicles, military vehicles of all widths. I mean, it's important to know that a Jeep is this wide at the wheel rims and that a 6x truck is this wide and so forth. And it's a bridge that fits all sizes of the standard equipment. Tanks, you know, and they didn't lose one. Not one of them went over. It was, you know, not a long haul, but it was scary as hell. And there were trucks where you couldn't unload the people because you couldn't carry enough of them across.
And you have to see this. You have to see, and Google Earth doesn't even do it justice because it's a completed road now. When you see the old video of what the bridge at that plant look like, it's been blown. And you look at the elevation and you think you've got to be kidding me. You've absolutely positively have to be kidding me.
They didn't go through all that saving themselves. It's just to get screwed up by one bridge.
Yeah, I can imagine. Can you imagine that? Look, somebody better make this work, okay? We didn't do all that work to come here and have this happen.
Well, you know, in a pinch, you could have 15,000 guys doing Wile E. Coyotes.
That certainly wouldn't have been worthy of the story. All right, so final question for you. In retrospect, when you get to this time of the year, and you think of this, in my opinion, a friend of mine argues that Guadalcanal is the Marine Corps' finest hour. I think that the Chosin is. When you think of this, what do you think of?
Well, I'm biased. Chosin was my first big people's book. It wasn't my first book, but it was one that I started, I did my research in a year, I wrote it in a year, and it took a year for the publisher to get it out. It was probably one of my more concise works in terms of period I worked on it. I think it's my best writing job, because I didn't know what I was doing and I had to invent how I wrote. And it's my favorite, still my favorite.
Why? For those reasons?
I'm sorry?
For all those reasons, it's your favorite.
It's my baby, yeah.
I like that.
It was well reviewed. I got Lem Shepard. I was trying to think earlier today, how did I get Lem Shepard to write the introduction to the book?
How did you?
Here it is, General Lemuel C. Shepard, Jr., United States Marine Corps, retired.
How did you get
his
book?
FMS pack at the during the reservoir.
Was it well received among Marines? Did you hear from?
Yeah,
did you hear from many Marines?
This was the first
major work that came out about Chosin. Yes.
Yeah, they didn't know me, but they knew Chosin, and they'd only had official histories up till that point, as far as I can remember. I mean, I look at the bibliography, and there's like five books in the bibliography, and then all of them I think are official books,
right,
of one kind or another.
Right.
I mean, I did the research. I talked to probably 300 people.
Oh.
Or talked or corresponded with them. And that was where I got my good sense of the Marine Corps. I mean, that whole discussion we had about, the pros reverting to the roots of their professionalism and knowing what to do at all ranks and stations. That came from you know, working this material, you know, with, you know, down to my finger stubs. It left me with a lot of respect for individuals, and I met a lot of these people. I was always impressed by the people I met.
My guest today has been none other than himself, Eric Hamill. The book is called Chosin, and this time of year, if you're a Marine or a fan of military history, United States type, American type, then your thoughts at some point can't help but skew to one of the epic battles of the Marine Corps, and that is the Chosin Reservoir campaign. And you know, it still echoes in eternity. The president of South Korea recently came to the United States for the first time, and the first place that he went officially was to the National Museum of the Marine Corps, and was the guest of General Neller, and wanted to pay his respects to the Marine Corps because his family is one of the North Korean families that accompanied the 1st Marine Division out of the area of the Chosin Reservoir, and he would not be the president of South Korea were it not for the courageous actions of Task Force Faith and the entire 1st Marine Division. So it still echoes in history. So Eric, first of all, thank you as always. Thank you. It's a privilege to have you on All Marine Radio. Thank you very much for doing this.
It's been my pleasure.
All right.
We'll
take a break. No, just so we'll tease him. Just so everybody knows, we're going to do this again. Coming up is after the first of the year. I think going to be republished is the book on your book on Kaesong.
Kaesong and my book on Hue.
All right.
50th anniversary of both of them, of Tet.
There's a little event that we should cover. A final question. Did you watch the series, The Vietnam War by Ken Burns?
I couldn't get it. I kept locking it into my television, my VCR, and it never recorded.
I'd be curious to know your thoughts on it. All right, sir. Thank you very much for the visit today, and we will talk to you about Hue and Kaesong down the road. Thank you very much.
All right, good. Take care of yourself. Bye.
All right, thank you. That is Eric Hamill, recorded that yesterday afternoon, talking about the Chosin Reservoir campaign. We'll do a number of interviews about that. And so the video that you watch now, given all the different things that they do with video and all the different places they've found it, is astounding. Absolutely astounding. So I would recommend, there's a couple of documentaries that I would recommend to you. And then there's a download that I'm going to put on the website that has push pins for Google Earth. So if you're a dork like me that when they read, you know, you want to look. And I'll tell you what, and if you take a look at, you know, the dirt road that is called an MSR, you look at the back and forth, the cutbacks and all the, you know, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing, what they did. And again, when you look at the fight as it lays out, Hagaruri is in the center. North of Hagaruri is the reservoir. To the east of the reservoir is Task Force Faith. To the west of the reservoir are the 5th and 7th Marines. First Marines, the 1st Marine Regiment strung out along the MSR with, Colonel Puller as its CO, and then, essentially the MLG, is at Hagaruri, which is at the bottom of the reservoir. The fight of the 5th and 7th Marines to get back to Hagaruri is an incredible fight in and of itself. And then, you know, the Task Force Faith is essentially destroyed, in its fight on the west side of the reservoir. So we'll continue to talk about those things. There's people that appeared in the documentary that I watched that I will get on the program and talk to them about their thoughts on the chosen reservoir and the fight up there. But 1950, so 67 years ago this winter. Yeah, wow. All right, that'll do it on a, we're about 30 minutes over, 34 minutes to be exact. That'll do it on a Wednesday, hump day. Bonus coverage. The president speaking now. The United States is beginning the process of moving its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So stand by for everything that's going to go on with that. My thanks to former Marine Sergeant Craig Grossi. He has written a book called Craig and Fred. There's an adult version. There's also a kid's version. A young reader version. And you can buy both of them. You can go to the website, Fred the Afghan. And you can go ahead and find out everything that they have going on. You see pictures of both of them. Fred's a good-looking dog, and very cool story. So my thanks to him for coming on to do part two of the interview. Also, my thanks to Eric Hamill, who's become a friend of the program, a prolific Marine writer, a man who certainly needs no introduction here on All Marine Radio. So my thanks to him for coming on, and most of all, my thanks to you for listening. Have a great Wednesday. This program repeats itself, so if you're just tuning in, it's a good one. So don't touch that dial. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.